for joining us and for driving that surgery session. If you're going to jump off, then do, because I'm going to talk to Kathy now about subject requests. And we ran a session last week, kind of we're trying to highlight seven ways to simplify subject tax requests. So we're trying to again make it a bit of a practical session, but we've been running a subject tax request bureau for 2 years maybe, and you know we've learned an awful lot in that time about how to make it efficient, how to make it effective, and you know again it's an interactive session, so if people have got questions then they should ask them, they should chip in, they should comment. You know we want to involve, we want to hear from people. So we're going to talk about subject tax requests now and hopefully ways to simplify it. Ollie, thanks very much for that. It was really interesting. I do like working with the Pecker. I do like that particular client because they come up with some fantastic use cases, don't they? Because they're pushing the commercial, they're pushing the boundaries all the time.
No, yeah. Absolutely. No, very fabulous. Thanks, Phil. I shall be back in about an hour's time. Until then, take care, everyone.
Right. Thank you very much, Ollie. Kathy, hello.
Hello.
How's your morning going?
Busy, busy as always.
Busy as always. So we did this session. I have to say, as I said the other day, I didn't expect to rerun it, so I threw all my notes away, which is always a bad move. So I'm not sure that we'll be able to replicate what we did last week. In fact, hopefully we'll be able to improve upon it. But the you do want to quickly introduce, you know, SARS and the Bureau, yeah. and then we'll get into, you know, what you know, the process really effectively, and then having a look at, you know, how we can shortcut the process, improve the process, improve the efficiency of the process, and, you know, and the challenges that we see, not only with our Bureau, but with the, you know, in the clients that we're working for.
Yeah, that's fine.
Over to you.
Okay, so my introduction to SARS, apart from being involved remotely in my previous life, the first day that I think I joined Data Protection People, I had a huge SAR.
You did indeed. You did.
I didn't have a clue what I was doing, other than I had a pretty good idea what the client, you know, what the data subject was looking for. So, you know, I was quickly able to identify that this person either had a case or didn't have a case. And the long shot of it was, I think at the time that the data subject changed their mind and was paid off, which is a route a lot of people go down. However, it's often very unnecessary. So it was at that point that I started to think about, you know, a better process and, you know, taking this on seriously. And as you said, we stumbled around with SARS for a while to start with, and then we quickly got our ducks in a row. So we've now been running the...
It's not meant to be a warts and all session, bearing our dirty washing, Kathy, but no, appreciate the honesty.
It's a lesson learned. So if you're going to do basically, you know, don't take it lightly, because there's an awful lot to take in, and having a good process is certainly part of it. So basically there's two types of SAR requests. So there's usually an internal one and an external one. The internal one is probably easier to deal with in terms of, you know, you can request them to fill in a form.
Internally, I mean, it's somebody within the organisation. Externally, I mean, somebody outside the organisation.
Yeah, usually an employee, generally. Yeah. And obviously, part of your set procedure is to fill in a SAR form. I've got an echo, I'm not sure why, but... Yeah, I can hear. So, yeah, normal SAR form, and obviously getting the details right in there, you know, a list of, you know, the data that they require, you know, dates that they want, you know, any specific information, etc., etc. And that's generally the start of when you find out you've got a SAR, usually, if it's internal. External is slightly different. You can't insist that they fill in a form as such. You know, they can send you an email, they can verbally ask for it, they can ring you up and ask for it. However, it's usually a good idea to try and capture it in an email, you know, so asking the data subject if they would mind putting that in writing. I mean, of course they can say no, but it does help to get it into, you know, into writing wherever possible. And then the second part then is an internal scoping form. So ideally you should have your own scoping form that captures all the information that you need to process the data subject request, which includes information that IT might need, you know, what files is this the information in, what are they asking for, you know, what are the dates from and to, etc. You know, what's the background to the request? Is it a disciplinary, a redundancy? Is it, you know, just because they can? What sort of information, you know, capture their roles and responsibilities and email addresses, nicknames. I mean, these are just general things, but believe it or not, people don't think of them. So often when we get a...
So what you're saying is, in a way, establish a good scoping form with all the relevant questions that you know you're going to need to ask to commission an information search and find personalization in the first place. You know, ideally try and narrow down the scope of the search to specific date ranges or specific topics or specific systems, you know, I'm quite moany about standardized forms, but a good form to do that, to record that information, is a real bonus, isn't it? Because it means you've got a consistent approach to all the SARs as they come in. You're going to ask the same questions. And didn't you have an issue recently last week with the SAR we were handling where the client changed a brief partway through, so we had to stop the whole thing and start again looking for phone numbers because they weren't part of the original brief to try and identify people in the data set?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this we get this all the time. I mean, we love a good form. And we love a good form that's filled in very well because, you know, people, you know, we often get a SAR request and there's no title on there. There's no, we don't know what we're...
Come in too far.
Stop. Turn the light on.
Oh, God.
We don't know, we don't know what this person does in the organisation.
I don't know how many to
call. In the organisation. So, you know, it really does matter. And then there's also things like, you know, is this person getting legal advice? Do we need to look out for... you know, management forecasting and planning, you know, which planning, do we need to look anything around settlements, you know, protected conversations. So if there's going to be information in emails from lawyers to HR.
So what's the point of you? I mean, some of this doesn't sound, you know, you, when you're maybe setting off on a SAR approach, you think, you know, I'm thinking now, well, why do we need all this stuff? But what I think what you're alluding to is once you've got, you know, who's going to be doing the review of the documentation that comes out in information search, you know, and what you're going to be training them, what you're going to ask them to look for, how you're going to fence stuff and treat it with, you know, because it might be exempt from disclosure, you know, might be a redundancy situation or something that's subject to legal privilege. And unless you get this thought through at the start of the process, you're running against a tide, aren't you? And the clock's ticking all the way with this.
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is get as much information as you can, and you got to think about, which isn't going to tell you all this. You know, when we're doing the drafting up the information search parameters, you know, we are making up, well, have a look for this, you know, initials, have a look for that, you know, first name only, have a look for that, variations on first name, because again, we've got to appreciate that when we're doing an information search, it's using technology and it will look for specifically and exactly, you know, what you ask it to look for. It won't think, oh, that's a misspelling or I'll have a look at that. It just looks for what you're asking. So if you've got telephone number, colon, and then a number, that's what's going to be searched for. And of course, it won't find that. It'll find, you know, if you put in a number, it would find it in a telephone number field. But again, we've got to be really precise. And I think that we are really precise because we're really a bit anal about it, aren't we? But you've got to be really precise about defining exactly what you want the IT team or whoever's doing the searching for the data to search for. You get it wrong, you're not going to get the right information out of the system.
Correct. And also this form is also used for, you know, not only getting IT to look for the right information, but also to understand if, for example, HR need to see, you know, they're looking for something specific. So having a section for keywords in your scoping form, you know, if you're looking for things related to absence or disciplinary or, you know, occupational health.
This is kind of premised on you've got great software. So one of my top tips is get great software for dealing with a SAR. So what happens with our system is that, you know, we will tell the client, look for all these words, and when you find them in the email system or the Z drive or the, you know, WhatsApp, whatever it is, drag all that information together. We then shunt it into our SAR platform, and that has got the capability of looking at every single page of every single document and scoring it and finding these search terms. So what you get out at the end of that process ranked and scored document set, maybe 100,000 documents, but you know fine well that all these contain the word confidential information. All these contain the words, you know, redundancy or harassment. And therefore, you can ring fence that whole bunch of documents and get someone to look at it specifically. And they might have a narrower brief themselves. You know, you're looking at things like of this nature, and we think it's protected by an exemption. So if you haven't got great tools, a lot of what we're talking about, you might be thinking, well, how would I use that? But you do need some really good software to manage large volumes of data, don't you, if that's how the SAR is going to be held with it. When we're working on paper, all that stuff is irrelevant, isn't it, to some extent?
Well, it isn't relevant. So even in the scoping form, when we're not dealing with huge SARs, you know, it's still always good to highlight key information that you're looking for, because, you know, when you're trawling through thousands of emails, even on the manual process, we can still search for keywords. You know, and we can then segregate those into different folders that, you know, HR might want to go through, or, you know, the lawyer might want to see, or, you know, and we can give them access to that. So, you know, I suggest that's, you know, it's certainly a good way forward. So once you've got your scoping, once you've got your form filled in, once you've got your scoping request and you're happy that it's, you know, it's good to go, then the next thing is, you know, it's briefing the team. So, you know, it's not a case of just verbally slinging it over the fence and saying, right, come on, crack on, let's review it.
Let me just go kind of back a step. So did you think that a form, you know, forms part of an actual good, well-documented process of how SARs are going to get handled? So again, it's a scalable and certainly a repeatable task. You know, it always follows this path, and scoping being one of the principal steps, but after scoping falls these other steps. So everyone in the organisation knows this is the process for handling a rights request.
Correct. But also, as part of probably a slight step back before all of this, is that, you know, every company needs to have their own policy on subject requests, because, you know, each company that we deal with, you know, a lot of them have different ways of dealing with it, and that has to be, you know, determined at the start before you start to do SAR work. Because, you know, if you don't have a company policy, how are you going to redact things? You know, what you're going to keep in, what you're not going to keep in, what you're going to provide. You know, it's very difficult then to pass that on to somebody to, you know, to review and start reviewing it without a sort of, you know, policy set at the beginning. So, for example, a lot of our clients heavily redact, which sort of means, you know, anything that's going to identify a third party, so the name, telephone number, title, whether they're internal, external, you know, if they could be identified by he, she, you know, etc. It's not a favourite way of doing it, you know, the way that we do it. Obviously, we try and, you know, provide as much as possible to the data subject that they are entitled to. But obviously, you know, anything that we, you know, is going to cause harm or identify another third party other than an employee, we tend to provide. Now, if it is an employee, you know, there is no problem with taking out the employee's name or title or, you know, whatever that might be. But I mean, normally most people leave it in. You know, you need to clarify, do you want the data subject to have anything to, from, or CC emails as standard in your policy? You know, so all these things should be agreed first hand, and then obviously the form is the next bit that you fill in, the scoping form, as a standard, have these areas ticked already.
Yeah. So you're talking about training. So again, that's absolutely critical to make sure that you've got a repeatable process. Everyone is doing what you've just described in exactly the same way, because we've had scenarios where we do QA checks, don't we, during the day, at the end of every day. When our review team is on with a project, and we have found that, you know, when we brought a new member of the team, for instance, you know, you get trained, they get briefed, we then start them off an hour later, we have a team briefing, and they've been treating things differently, and then that all has got to get reworked. So getting everybody on the same page, exactly the same process, knowing exactly how to, and what we do is we take screenshots, don't we, of typical documents, and we highlight up this. If you come across one of these emails, for instance, you got to leave in the two. You got to cut out the CCs. You got to cut out the subject. You got to whatever else. You know, so we actually visually mark up some examples, and we put in a PowerPoint, and we have a team training session, don't we? And then we have a daily start of day session and a daily end of day session. So we're getting feedback from the team then to say, Yeah. You know, what about these? I've not come across this type of thing before. You know, how are we meant to be treating it? Somebody else might say, well, I came across it. I did it like this. So unless you've got a really, really good process, you know, to manage all that. And bear in mind, you know, we've got a full-time bureau of people doing this. If you don't get many SARs, you, as we found in some of our clients, dragging all the admin staff in from, you know, the business to process a SAR. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't done it before. Getting them on the same consistent process is paramount, isn't it? Training is that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really risky getting somebody doing a SAR that's not got a clue, you know, in terms of data protection and just the process. I mean, all of our, you know, I mean, we've got 20 reviewers and QAs on top of that. And regardless of whether they've had training before, for every SAR we get, they have a PowerPoint brief, and that's the first start of the training. And, you know,
so each project's different, isn't it? Each project is different.
They're all different. You know, sometimes we've got three people involved in a SAR, and, you know, we have to treat those three separately, or, you know, one might have permission for others, or agreed that they all share the data. So it's always a different case. So, yeah. You know, the PowerPoint really covers all that. It, you know, it tells you what to do with two from a CC. It tells you what to do with attachments. It tells you what to do with business as usual, you know, what to look for, what to share. You know, it tells you all that. But obviously, you know, normally a couple of hours into doing the work on the SAR, the QAs are then checking individuals' work. And as you say, rightly so, at the end of each day, you know, you might be called onto a catch up. Obviously, it's on Teams now, so it's a bit more difficult. And, you know, we go through the work that that reviewer's done and get them to correct it. Just so that we're all on the same page, because you just can't afford to let it go. Otherwise, you're back reviewing, you know, and trying to play a catch up to see where the work is. And as you get into the SAR, you find out that, you know, the QAing job gets less and less because, you know, the five or six QAs are on it. You know, they've got it. They're all working the same way.
Managing kind of, I want to come back to this. In fact, two things. So I've written them down so don't forget. Confidentiality and selecting who's in that team of reviewers. But, I mean, this QA, this notion of QAing. So the process ideally is, that somebody reviews a document and determines whether it contains personal data or not, and whose personal data, and whether that personal data is the personal data of the requester, and whether an exemption applies, and this third-party data, is it reasonable to disclose in this specific circumstance of this case? All that type of stuff the reviewer does. They mark up a document, and, you know, if we're using our WYSI Nuix platform tool, it goes into QA queue, doesn't it? And a QA or a separate person picks it up and reviews that work and either approves it or modifies it. And if there's lots of modifications, then obviously we tweak the team training. But tracking that, if you're not using Nuix, it's much harder, isn't it? Because we're doing it in something like Adobe, you know, DC, where we're, you know, I know a lot of people might do this, where you're manually marking up, you know, well, digitally marking up, but there's no metadata, there's no database system, there's no tracking of who's done what when. And that is critical, isn't it? I love the Nuix platform because it gives us a log file of who's owned what, who's done.
But also what you've got to, you know, what we're talking about these days is a lot of the businesses or clients that we've got, you know, if they're doing their own SAR work, they are going to be doing it on Adobe or something like, because, you know, obviously Nuix is very expensive and it, you know, and it's only good to use for volume, you know, it can prove quite expensive for anything sort of under 5,000 pages. However, if you've got a good process, you know, and you are doing it manually, you know, I tend to not put too many people on the same SAR. So, you know, if there's quite a load of different files, you know, we might put one person on the HR stuff, you know, one person on the other emails, etc. Everything gets logged. We log everything, you know, what the document is, how many pages it is, what's it about, what's the outcome, you know, have we redacted third-party data, is it disclosable, is it not disclosable, why is it not disclosable, is it a duplicate? You know, you've got to be able to go back and track the work that you've done. And obviously, you know, we have QA, but we also have final level, whereas, you know, me or A, another person, will just check the log against the documents and, you know, any exemptions that are in there. Because we've got a brief, you know, you've got to brief the person to communicate with the subject.
Yeah, and also having a facility for obtaining a second opinion. Again, we some really technically complicated SARs. We we're not sure. You know, we have to have a, you know, literally have to have a debate, don't we, amongst the senior consultants. You know, is this personal data? Yeah. And then we delve into the guidance again, and we're looking at, you know, whatever is in a document, and we're saying, you know, we're not sure it is, and therefore we're documenting why that particular, in the log, why that document doesn't contain personal data. But you know, we don't expect our reviewers, the reviewers who are doing the first pass, speed is really important, and we can't have them, you know, dwelling on stuff. They need to be able to make a decision as quickly as they can, and if they can't make a decision, then they throw it into a second opinion queue. Again, we can manage that on UX, and when you're doing it in a different way, then you've got to think about, you know, who is going to be picking up these you know, these more difficult notions and these more difficult cases. Talk to me about paper, Kathy, because we still get a lot of paper SARS in, don't we? Particularly from schools.
Yeah, particularly in education, because obviously, you know, councils hand the information back to the schools, and you know, I know an instance where they just dumped thousands of boxes back in a school because they weren't looking after the school anymore. So, you know, we do get a lot of that. I mean, I cannot see the point in anybody wasting the time with a highlighter highlighting data and going back and forward, because it's difficult. You know, it costs money. It's so much cheaper. There's loads of you know, companies around that do a really good job, you know, confidentiality wise, scanning information, you know, sending it to you on a, you know, giving them access to a shared folder. They pop it in there. Yeah. You know,
it's quick, isn't it, as well. That's what, yeah, you
know, some of
that,
the,
that's
some,
what we do. Yeah,
some of the manual redaction I've seen is terrible.
Yeah, you know, but it's much better if you can get a trusted supplier, you know, do your due diligence, and ideally get that done in advance rather than when you're up against documents, and create PDFs, get the cartons of documentation delivered to them. They'll scan them in a matter of hours, won't they? Because these are companies, yeah, that are set up to do that. It's all done in a closed loop, so there's a fairly secure environment, and we get back, you know, either one, you know, or several PDFs, and then it goes into our normal PDF management process. So again, it's actually remarkably cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very cheap, very efficient. And also what you've got to remember is then you've sort of, you know, the manual stuff, obviously they shred for you, which is great, and you get a certificate to say they've shredded it. But also, you know, the organization, you know, you've now got electronic files of that information. Which you probably wouldn't have had before, because, you know, you never know when a data subject's going to come back to you for something that, you know, they might know is there, that, you know, that they need providing. So, you know, I wouldn't advise anybody doing manual redaction with ink. It's, you know, with the right pens, it's just, you know, it's a pain.
I tell you, I want to come back onto that log file. So I have been in situations in the past where I mean, this is going back 10, 12, 15 years, where we were doing subject access requests and logging everything in an Excel file, and where they have been questioned and brought into the ICO, where people have challenged them. The ICO first thing to say is, you know, send over your policies, your procedures, and your log file. So if you send over a really good looking process and a really good looking log of all the documentation and how it was treated, you know, this was a duplicate of that one, you know, this one was partially redacted because of the application of this exemption. If it looks like, in my experience anyway, if it looks like you've got a robust and a good process, the ICO will be very supportive, let's say. So I've always found the ICO kind of telling me about this person's complaint, right, this is how we treated it, this is a log file, this is our set of procedures, fine. You know, they've always found in favour of the data controller. And I say that, you know, on occasions, against our advice, the client has decided to deliberately withhold information that might be embarrassing, but you can't find it when there's a good looking process in place.
Yeah, that's happened before. But I think the biggest problem that people have is determining business as usual and personal data. I mean, even ourselves sometimes, you know, with our reviewers, you know, we get them putting stuff in second opinion that, you know, I'll look at it and in 2 minutes go, well, that's not personal data.
So just dig into that, because I always pick you up on this, don't I? You by business as usual, you mean, you know, I don't know, 10,
let me give you an example.
1,000 emails to have a look at. Go on, yeah. And yeah, go on, give us an example.
Well, this person works in finance, you know, and they're putting a SAR request, and basically they're asking for everything, which is, you know, is often the case. They're not going to make it easy. You know, if they've got a grievance about something, you know, most of it is there because they think something's gone on untoward, or, you know, they're after some information that they think is there. Now, if they're in finance and they're doing weekly or monthly or quarterly forecasts on business revenue, you know, targets for the business, you know, all that sort of thing, they're not entitled to any of that. And that's why businesses really need to stop, to avoid attaching, you know, weekly, monthly reports that are just, you know, reports to the business. However, in that email with that attachment, if it says, you know, what are you doing for lunch afterwards, shall we meet so and so, then that bit is personal data. So the content of the email, you know, the attachment, which is the forecast, would be redacted, but the you know, the personal chat on there would be disclosed. And, you know,
and often, that's a part, you know, of the problem though, isn't it?
Yeah, that is part,
yeah,
of the
problem. That's a challenge. So
yeah,
it's sifting out, you know, what is out of a data set that's being returned from an information search. You know, you're going to get attachments to emails, you're going to be PowerPoint presentations. Oh, I went to this ICO conference on the age appropriate design code of conduct and here's a presentation. Yeah. Well, you know, that's clogging up. You know, someone's got to review that, determine it's not got personal data in it, yeah, and rule it out as business as usual, as you would class it. But that whole kind of process, it gets bogged down by all these attachments. I mean, emails are the biggest, well, unstructured data is probably the biggest problem of all to actually find anything in. But emails, they just exponentially expand, don't they? So I've got a gigabyte worth of emails. Well, how many is that? I don't know. Right. How many is it? It's 10,000. Well, how many pages is that? Oh, that's 25,000 pages. Oh, and there's a load of attachments. Well, that's now 250,000 pages. Well, you know, we work out how many pages per hour a reviewer can get through, you know, and it is pages orientated, isn't it?
Yeah, but Nuix obviously does help a lot more on that. So, you know, our expertise, you know, if I receive a lot of data and, you know, obviously we sort it into PDFs to start with, so this is a manual process, I can pretty much identify by the titles what is 95% going to be business as usual. And obviously then we would sample them and make sure that, you know, the six reports with the same name, different date are all exactly the same thing. Now on UX, obviously it helps even more on there because we can ask for all reports, attachments to all be put into separate folders. And when we do that, then we can run a report, you know, and it'll tell us that we've got, I don't know, 20 forecasts for each month of the year for however many years. So, you know, we can sample all those for the client and we can report back quickly that, you know, they're not personal data, and that gets rid of absolute thousands of pages. But obviously you can avoid that, you know, from now on you can avoid that by, you know, attaching account information, you know, housing reports, tenants reports, etc. You know, people should start moving into putting stuff into shared folders and just telling people, you know, once a month, your forecast will be in the accounts folder.
It's like our Salesforce system churns out absolute ton of reports, doesn't it? And they come out scheduled every, and so he knows, you know, sends them out to a distribution list. So if we were doing a subject access request for you, for instance, we would be delving into the Outlook system and we'd be pulling out anything that's, you know, to, from, CC, CAF, mission, and there'd be a ton of Salesforce reports. And the clue of this isn't personal data might be in the title. You know, it's from Salesforce and, you know, it's called, you know, remuneration report or forecast, sales forecast report. So you might be able to deduce that it's unlikely to contain personal data. Have a look at a small sample and then kind of rule the rest out. That's generally the approach we would take into it. But I don't like doing sweeping of judgments like that because I'm always terrified or nervous of missing, you know, personal data. But maybe in the grand scheme of things, things like that are unlikely to contain anything of particular. Yeah,
I mean, in the old days, you know, whatever department I've worked in, you know, there's been monthly or quarterly or, you know, reports that have to go to the board at a certain time every month. And, you know, we've all done it. You know, you share that with the person that's putting the board pack together, you know, and they're in there. But, you know, when you look at them, there's no personal data in there whatsoever. However, you know, that doesn't mean that all attachments don't have personal data in, because you might get an employee salary list or a commission list, and you know that person may be on there. With Excel, it's really difficult. So with Excel, you're better off, you know, using the find and search and then copying, cutting and pasting that bit of personal data onto, you know, another individual spreadsheet, so that you're not, you know, you're not having to go through and redact all the other 200 people on there.
Yeah, because people, that's a really good point, Kathy, because people aren't entitled to a document. They're entitled to any personal data contained within the document. So getting, as we've done, you know, getting a screenshot of personal data within an enormous spreadsheet satisfies the legal requirement, doesn't it? You don't have to supply the redacted document, like 400 black, I mean, literally 400 black pages and one page with the tiny little segments of it not blacked out. Yeah. Get that segment. But I mean, we do have clients that take the opposite approach, don't we? One particularly springs to mind where their approach wasn't overly redact things. Our strategy is we'll bury the respondent, the requester, in paperwork. You know, if they want everything, right, they can have it. 100,000 pages, get through that lot, you know, in your lifetime. So some people take that opposite approach, don't they? Whereas, you know, if there is something, you know, that is in the documentation, they're not bothered, you know, especially if it's information they've seen before. You know, they're part of an email trail, for instance. Well, they've seen it before, they can have it, all of it.
Well, that's why you need to get your policy right in the first place, because a lot of people just think, you know, they start to look for the data subject's information, and like you say, they might come up with, you know, 100,000 pages, or we've seen more. You know, and straight away they start, you know, getting into conversation about paying this data subject off. Well, you know, half the time, you know, that is a waste of money, because by the time you've got down the data that's actually relevant to the person, you know, it's nothing like what it's going to cost you to pay somebody out.
It's amazing how much we take out, isn't it? So you get the initial files, digital files, and we can usually take out 40% through a deduplication process where, you know, the system compares every single document with every other document in the set and says this is an identical copy. You know, it's an email that's sent out, you know, from several people or, you know, whatever. So we can normally take a big chunk out by deduplicating the data set. But I'm always surprised how little personal data there is that meets the scope of the request from what we supplied in the first place. I mean, we're talking thousands of pages out of 100,000, aren't we, sometimes?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's that's why, you know, you need to get your policy sorted in the first place, because, you know, as a company, you need to know exactly what you're looking for. And, you know, it's the same with looking for reviewers. You can't just throw anybody at it. You know, if it's an employee data subject request, you know, you don't want anybody having access to, you know, an employee's HR record, disciplinary. You know, they might know this employee outside work, you know, they might not tell you that, they might still have contact with it. You know, it needs to be a proper confidential set of people that are going to be working. I mean, you know, I suppose that's why, you know, we have QA internal people, and then we have a lot of outside reviewers who are, you know, I think we've got an inspector, a lot of teachers, deputy heads, you know, headmistresses, etc. That, you know, they've got the attention to detail. But these people also need to be able to, you know, it's almost like a CV of what these people look like, you know, attention to detail. They've got patience, you know, they don't get bored easily. You know, they see every job as a really good challenge. They want to get the job done. You know,
they're used to handling confidential information as well. Absolutely. They understand the importance of it.
They know not to start discussing it everywhere else. I mean, you know, it's really hard to get people like that. But also the QAs are then a different level up, you know, so they need to have all those skills, but all obviously be able to, you know, if in doubt, shout up, you know, always get a second opinion if required, you know, understand the exemptions more than a reviewer would. You know, if they're looking at something that's really sensitive, you know, they have to have the ability to be able to say, look, I don't like how this is reading. What do you think we should do? Should we speak to the client about it? Or, you know, do we need to speak to our HR team?
Yeah.
So you just need to make sure that, you know, you've got a good spec of the people that you're going to be asking to review this information.
Yeah. And confidentiality is really important. Again, we should talk about this because we found when we're doing SARs that there's a whole load of company data, depending who's raised the SAR. If it's senior management, for instance, there's a whole load of highly confidential information, you know, about the business and its operation. I'm going to come on to your question in a minute, Sian, about who deals with the SAR, but this is kind of linked. But we did have one occasion where one of the people on the client side who was helping us to review the information found very disparaging comments about them and resigned on the spot.
We've had...
So, you know, you don't know what's in there, and you've got to be mindful of the fact that they might find information about themselves in there. They might find information about potential acquisitions or mergers or the company being in financial trouble. So you've got to really view team carefully.
I'm really not a fan of, you know, anybody out of HR reviewing employee sales, because, you know, it usually ends in tears. But also we have had that exact scenario. We've also had a scenario where, you know, one of our clients had a QA on there that you know was deemed to look at any sensitive information or, you know, legally privileged, and there was certain information they didn't want him seeing, you know. So we had to we had to divert some of that into other folders. And, you know, this is why it's not, you know, you can't just pick and choose who's going to do the QA and the review, and you have to be very sure
Sean's saying, is it feasible the data subject could specifically request that certain people do not deal with their SAR? And I think yes, it is. I mean, it's not something that's specifically called out in the provisions for a SAR, but, you know, the whole notion of access control and security and data minimization, you know, the data protection principles would suggest that, you know, if somebody has got a real case why they don't want a particular team or a particular individual having access to or working on the SAR, having access to the data, then I think that to me it stands up, because you know it's supported by the data protection principles. Now, how far you take that, I don't want anybody to have a look at it, you know, well, you know, there must be people that are authorized to see the types of information that are in the data set. But I think in principle I'd say yeah, if somebody didn't want someone to have a look at
it. I've actually had that happen in a previous job that I had, that, you know, the SAR request was from somebody in HR and they didn't want the other HR colleagues to be reviewing it, which is I ended up reviewing it. But yeah, I get that.
Yeah. Shyster's raised, again, a great point. You know, my approach is that anyone who's been included in the SAR request should be separate from the entire process. Yeah, good point. Sometimes you don't know whose information's in the information retrieved from the request. So that becomes challenging. But I mean, if you can kind of set out, as Kathy said, if you can set out your general approach, your process, the decisions you're making at the very start of the process through policy and through procedure and through operating procedures, then so much the better. The last thing you want to be doing is being under a time pressure and having to make it up or change course, because you've got this whole load of effort behind you, and to change course during the SAR is you've got to stop everything and potentially review a load of reviewed information. It's a major undertaking. Kathy, transferring data, I mean, I would say at the end of the process, you know, everyone breathes a big sigh of relief, like, we've got all this stuff off to the requester, bang, let's forget about it. That's a mistake, isn't it? Because sometimes they come back to haunt you, and without a good log file of how you treat everything, you know, you just move on to the next thing. But 2 months later, someone comes back to you. We've had
people come back to us, you know, as you know, longer than that. And we've had to trench through an old archive system to try and find stuff. But I mean, our policy now is that we don't keep, you know, if we've done a data subject for somebody, we don't keep the information. What we do is ask the client to move it across to their servers, which obviously if you're doing it yourself, then it's already on your servers. And we delete it. Once they tell us to delete it, we delete it. I suppose if it's your own information, then you have to put that in your policy as to how long you're going to keep that, so that, you know, when somebody's, if somebody's constantly coming back and it's, you know, years and years later, then you can refer them to your privacy policy.
There's a balance here, isn't there? So this question came up last week on the takeaway, and I think the contribution for everyone was that the ICO, I think, says 2 years for SARs that they handle. And I think the comment was, well, if it's good enough for the ICO, 2 years retention on SAR information is good enough for me, which is fair enough. But, you know, if you've got a particular requester that is constantly, you know, putting in SAR requests and you're having to top up the data each time, then, you know, there is a case for keeping, you know, it a bit longer in case you've got a similar request, or, you know, there's not necessarily excessive that comes in. You want to be able to say, well, this is what we gave you last time and this is what's changed in the meantime. But you know, there is you want to be this you know, SAR response information indefinitely, there is bound by retention guidelines as well. But I'm thinking, you mentioned on Friday last week about the case where a client sent off the whole load of information, you know, password protected, but the password was in with the DVD, which went missing in the post. I mean,
Well, we've had that a few times. We've had people put them on memory sticks and then put a note, a post-it note in with it with a password on. We've had people send out, you know, send it by email with the password with it. You know, people, they just don't think. But I mean, again, then that causes a big breach. And, you know, if it gets lost, you've got to do the work again. And, you know, it's just really, really messy. You know, there's lots of easier ways of sharing data. I mean, we don't email anything around the business in terms of, you know, personal data. It's all done through shared access. You know, if somebody wants us to do a SAR, you know, it either goes to Nuix direct, so it's picked up there, and, you know, nobody's got access to it. Apart from
even when we're under pressure, because sometimes the data load procedures just are taking time. There's gigabytes worth of data, and you always have to resist the temptation of shortcutting the process.
We do. It is tempting. I mean, now and again, if somebody can't get into the shared folders, or working remotely has been a bit of a challenge for a lot of people. You know, so you're trying to get them to share the data that you've worked on, and they can't pick it up because they haven't got enough Wi-Fi or whatever. It's a risk.
Yeah, I got my ears chewed off to majorly by a customer who wanted me to email all the output from the SAR. You know, and I said, no, it's in the SharePoint. You've got to go and get it. Oh, I can't get into it. Oh, I'm not emailing it. You know, it's just such a big risk. It's bad practice. But that's where
I'm quite laughing, actually, because we've got a client on here who probably knows what I'm talking about, that, you know, trying to share at work that we've done back to them. You know, you can't believe how difficult it was. You know, I had to review my internet access. You know, obviously I couldn't email it to them, and, you know, they were on a deadline and they were trying to pick it up. And, you know, it seemed like the impossible thing, but it was all down to do with the file size and trying, you know, for them to get on and pick it up. So, you know, again, we've got a much smoother system now for that. And, you know, because we didn't know it was a problem at the time, but it's just so frustrating.
Yes, it can be, can't it? Yeah. Right. OK, so we're coming towards the end of this session, I think, Kathy. I think we said we'd finish this one at 11:45 and then start, you know, looking at ICO and other guidance. So we've kind of built this as seven ways. Maybe there's more, maybe there's fewer ways of simplifying SAR. So what's kind of nutshell, kind of your overall, you know, top tips here, really, I suppose.
Well, I think it's, you know, everything that I said, get your policy correct, you know, at board level, sign off your report, agree what you're going to do, you know, obviously take the law into account when you're writing your policy. You know, again, these are things we could help with. You know, get a procedure in place. You know, this is what you do. You know, make sure in that procedure, you know, if it's internal, that, you know, they fill in the form for the request, then you scope it. If it's external, you know, you get what you can from the requester, but you still fill in the scope. From there, there's training on the SAR, you know, what team's going to do it, you know, what's the qualifications you need for these people. It, you know, it has to be, if you're going to do them regularly, it has to be using the same people and make sure that they're, you know, confidentially and trained. And then finally, making sure that you've got a really good QA system in place, and, you know, make sure you disclose it back properly.
Yeah, I'd kind of add on to that, you know, so yeah, process, procedure, form, team selection, training, log everything, you know, keep a good detailed log file, use the best tools you can afford to buy, you know, and have a backup plan. So if you get a monster SAR or lots of SARs, you know, there's bureaus like ours and there's others around that can provide that support. If you need external support on something very technical in terms of the law, then, you know, who you're going to go to. Again, ideally, that's all thought through and planned in the first place. And when it comes to transferring it, you know, transfer it in a secure way, and retain the information for a period of time in case people come back. Not necessarily, you know, you need to be able to pour back over it and see how decisions were made. And again, that's important because when we go through the process, we've got a group of original documentation and a group of redacted documentation, haven't we? So, yeah, you know, you can, if you only got redacted documentation, then you don't know what's been under the black lines because you've forgotten by the time people come back. So you've got to try and keep both, and then the cross-reference and index, that's where the system comes in, is really important. Otherwise, you know, trying to have a look for, you know, this particular document with the same name as you know, these 100 documents, it's hard work. So in your log file, you've got to give everything a unique ID so you can go back to a specific document and say, well, that's the one we need to have a look for in this other document set. Right, let's have a look at the unredacted. Yeah, you know, that should have been disclosed. So they're the kind of queries you get. But that's really useful. I don't know if anybody's got any further questions or comments to add in, any experiences to share. I mean, I don't know how many SARS people get. I mean, we have clients that get none and clients that get, you know, tons, you know, tons being 40 or 50.
Yeah, I think if you're going to get an odd SAR, you know, it's probably best always to do it in HR. If you're going to get, you know, an odd few, it's pointless then training up a team to do it. If you're going to get an odd few, you might as well outsource it because it's going to be cheaper. You know, for what you're buying into, you've got the resource and your specialised team. If you're getting them all the time, then that's a different story. You know, cost is going to be an issue. As you said, get the best tools, get the best trained people, you know, and try not make it part of the day job, because, you know, there's nothing worse than trying to do your day job and trying to do it, you know, a SAR properly. You just can't do it.
Under a lot of pressure, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right, so thank you very much, Kathy, for that. If nobody's got any questions or points, I mean, if you have, you by all means chuck them in. So we're going to have a look at ICO and other guidance, which keeps changing a lot. I mean, coming up a bit later on in the day, we've got another kind of data protection surgery. If we've got any questions, we'll coming in from the participants, then we will answer them or attempt to answer them. If we haven't, then Ollie might pick out another couple of interesting cases that we've currently got in the support desk to talk through. After that, we're going to, I don't know if you saw, but Matthew, our new recruit, wrote a fantastic blog, well, I thought it was fantastic, about how the Data Protection Act 2018 and the UK GDPR work together. Now, that again was prompted by a customer asking us to help explain it. So he wrote a great blog, and I thought it'd be useful just to talk through that and work through that about how they work in tandem, because you know, there seems to be some confusion about that potentially. Then we got small businesses, data protection for small businesses a little bit later on, and then the accountability session. Last thing today, we're going to talk about accountability and the accountability framework, and then we're going to have a look at a couple of different ways of managing your governance regime. So we're going to look at a bunch of spreadsheets. We've got like spreadsheets. We're going to have a look at those and talk through those pros and cons. We're going to have a look at our DataWise tool, which is information governance platform. I've got another tool we've got access to by a company called Sears, which is pretty good. And then maybe look at the Canil's DPIA tool, which is, again, free tool. It's pretty good. So we got all that coming up, but now we're going to, I think, if I've got some support from my colleagues, talk through, maybe I haven't, just talk through some of the guidance. That's the plan. Let me just see who's on the call. You're on the call, Miles, aren't you? Is anybody on from the consulting team? No, I think they've abandoned me. I'm just looking at Jason's comment here. Yeah. So you're picking up the point, Jason. I'm gonna pick this point up, but then I'm gonna talk through my takes on the guidance. I'm very happy, as I've got none of my colleagues on, for people to kind of dive in. But we've got a library of same as you've got, Jason, a library of guidance. Now, I have to say, the library like yours goes back to, I would have thought, 1998, 1999. Maybe a bit before that. I found some very old guidance from the original dame, I can't remember her name now, the very first commissioner. So if you've been in the game a long time, you've got a lot of this stuff, and some of it's irrelevant now, and it's all been superseded. But I've got quite a lot of guidance, and you need to keep your library up to date. And the more you add into it, and you know, it's hard to keep it well organized. But my big beef is that the ICO guidance may have a version number on it, but they don't tell you what's changed between the versions. So as I said earlier in the day, that I downloaded in prep for this session the new PECA guidance, which is version 2.4.49, and I checked our library, we had a version 2.4.37, and I thought, how have I missed 12 variations of the guidance? What has changed to justify putting out 12 different updates? And whilst there was a version on the latest guidance, there's no indication of what had changed. So I had to load both PDFs into a PDF comparison platform and check. And it appeared to me the only changes were the GDPR had been changed to the UK GDPR. But even so, you know, it's just hard work to have to go through that process. You're saying, Jason, also that the European data protection guidance is not supplemented to earlier Working Party 29 guidance, but replaces it. Maybe you come on and talk that one through. So I don't delete old guidance. I think a lot of it still has some interesting points. I just archive it. I don't know if you want to come on, Jason, and talk that one through. But I mean, in
do you want me to do that now?
Yeah, you can do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, than welcome.
As I said in the note, I see this as a new trend. I'd never previously seen an EDP document saying this replaces Working Party 29 guidance. I'm struggling to remember which document it was, but I might be able to find that in a moment. But if it does, it really makes version control so important now. Because it'd be very easy to say, oh, yes, I remember this. There's some WP29 guidance on it because it's a document that you're familiar with. Dive in and find that you're working on obsolete guidance, which has been totally replaced.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen the European Data Protection Board guidance saying that it either replaces or supplements. Some of it says it supplements. In fact, the new, it was the ICO's guidance, I said. Though similar, the data breach guidance, but it supplemented their own guidance, didn't it, I think, from memory. But that did say it was supplementary, the examples, data breach examples. So in our library, we've got the legislation. You know, we've got the EU GDPR, we've got the UK GDPR keyling, we've got the UK Data Protection Act keyling schedule, which has now replaced the old Data Protection Act copy we had. We've got various variations of the PECA, which is, again, that's quite hard to work with, 2003 original, plus all the variations to 2011, 15, 18, 19. We've got keep adding to it. So this week we were doing some work on the Communication Act 2003, so they'll put that in the library. We've got all the withdrawal agreement documentation in the library. Some of that will definitely become obsolete over the course of time. We've got RIPA, we've got IPA, anything that we come across as legislation, we add it into the library. But the principal things we work with on a day-to-day basis are the UK GDPR, the UK Data Protection Act and the PECA. And then we have kind of guidance. And I've put a list together of what I think is the key guidance. But when you look at the ICO's website, in fact, you know, we could have a look at it now, the guidance section for organisations is totally outdated, which is very, very unhelpful. And again, I'm not sure I particularly like the way that they have produced their GDPR guidance. So in the past, it was a downloadable PDF, but often when you log on and try and download the latest version of it to update your library, you can't download it. So it's a struggle. And as I said earlier, I find it difficult to work with totally electronic guidance because you click on hyperlinks and you're losing the flow of the guidance. So I find that particularly difficult. But the ICO's guidance, you know, there is some good stuff. And if you go back to the older guidance, like big data, the big data guidance I thought was really good when that was published back in 2014, I think it was. So there's a set of guidance the ICO has got, and you know the stuff that's really important is the statutory codes. So the Direct Marketing Code of Practice, again, this is in draft form. The Right of Access Code, which is in draft form and has been for nearly 2 years, and then the recently released Data Sharing Code of Practice statutory code, currently also in its draft form. The Children's Code, the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, is not in its draft form anymore, but it makes you wonder you know, what the relevance of the draft codes of practice are, because certainly the SAR guidance is significantly different between the current SAR guidance on the ICO's website and the draft guidance. And if you look for SAR guidance on the ICO's website, you go to the old guidance, the 47 pager. You have to know where the 77 page, the new guidance, is. And when you get hold of it, it doesn't have a cover page, so it doesn't look like it's official. And I think this is really confusing to people that aren't necessarily doing this every day of the week for a living. for us, you know, we take the latest guidance and we say, well, this is the direction of travel. And usually it's elaborating on stuff, but sometimes it makes significant changes. I heard an entry there.
Yes, that was me. I was about
to. Oh, Ollie, here. Hello.
I returned.
Right.
I returned and you were full flow, so I thought I'd let you finish your thought.
All right. So how are you getting on? All right? Busy morning?
Not so bad. I've been catching up with the support desk team, seeing what's what, where we are on various things, helping our new star recruit, Matthew, with a few bits and pieces. He's writing some privacy policies this morning, which I've been helping him with. But are we currently in the guidance?
We're just talking about guidance. Yeah, we're talking about guidance. I mean, I don't want it to be a moan about the ICO, but some of the stuff is good and some of the stuff is still in draft, and it has been for nearly 2 years. And we're looking for clear guidance that gives us, you know, cut through we can relate to, you know, use cases we can relate to. And some of it, you know, I was going through the direct market, subject access code of practice earlier in the week, and it's ambiguous. In fact, it contradicts itself partway through. It's just, it uses bad language in some places. I mean, I can give you a specific in a minute if I can find it. But what's your kind of library of guidance like, Ollie? Do you have your own library, and how do you keep it up to date?
I think because I caught the tail end of what you were saying previously, which is to sort of save the PDF copies to my own stash, if you like, of guidance.
Which
is good in a way, but obviously I think you referred to it earlier, because of the lack of version control, or at least the lack of fanfare around version control, it becomes a bit of a juggling exercise trying to make sure that your guidance is up to date when you go to rely on it. So to a degree, then it becomes a bit redundant to have your own library of guidance because you're constantly checking the website versions. Anyway, I did do a little bit of thinking about this this morning, because obviously there's sort of the, and I'm sure you will have said this, but the piece of guidance that you rely on more regularly, whether that's because they are topical areas which are a bit more complex and require you to look at the guidance more. So personally, the one that I'm always working in or around are the direct marketing code of practice, which is in draft.
I think that's very good. I think that's fabulous.
Like that one. Well, the thing being, obviously, that direct marketing and the rules and regulations around it is so grey and so woolly at times, particularly the laws, which are the regulations in PECA, which are very, very broad. You require that level of guidance. You require sort of a breakdown of what is actually, you know, direct marketing, or what is a solicited message, for instance. Well, that's possibly slightly easier to answer, but you take my point that by virtue of the topic area, the guidance is required. But there's also a whole lot of guidance that I don't rely on nearly as much as maybe I should. And there was one that came to mind when I was trying to think about it. Now, it's one of the ones possibly in line with something you mentioned recently, which is the fact that some of it's now out of date, or at least hasn't been updated since the introduction of the recent key statutory instruments. But one I was looking at a while ago and I thought was really good was the ICO's guidance on the use of cloud computing.
Yeah, that's really a good one.
Now that dates back to 2012, so some of the terminology is a bit out of date, but some of the concepts it touches on are actually really useful and really quite interesting. You sort of think it's a bit of a shame that there's, I mean, I suppose they don't maybe not have the resources for it, but it's a bit of a shame that it's not been brought up to date, because it touches on some very good and interesting concepts.
I think they are working through their guidance library, and most of the old guidance does say this is out of date, but we're working on it. But I wonder what resources they've got on writing guidance. You remember Phil Davison used to work for us. He spent 10 years at the ICO, but he was largely involved in writing a lot of their guidance. But you know, they have a team on it, but you know, surely it can't take that long to get through. You know, there's 40 pieces of guidance in there. Surely it can't take that long to get through it.
Well, see, I'm not sure on the number of pieces of guidance, because it's something we were referring to earlier, which is that they're not necessarily that easy to actually find. They don't have sort of a comprehensive index that you can go and look at and go, oh, I need to know about X. I'll go and check their their index, and I'll find what I need. So yeah, that's quite relevant. Yeah.
This is the bit that I was, I mean, maybe I've misread this or taking a strange view of it, but, you know, you're looking at this guidance, yeah, and if I was a relative layperson, you know, what's the basic rule? And it says here, you know, there's an exemption in the DPA that says if you don't have to comply with a SAR, if it would mean disclosing information about third party, you do have to comply with a SAR. You have to at least go back to them and say, we're not complying, you know, we're not going to disclose the data. But this is such a misleading statement, in my view. It's a highly misleading statement. I mean, they correct it later on, and they say here, you do need to respond, you know. But this whole kind of you don't have to comply is like, why use that language? The language of this guidance is critical, isn't it? Because we're reading into it, you know, what it actually says. And if you're defending your position, well, you said you don't have to comply. You know, well, you should have read further on. But it's like four pages further on.
Well, I'd assume you have to piece
things together sometimes, I think.
Yeah,
I'd
assume that particular turn of phrase comes from the fact that in the original law under Section 16, Schedule 2, Data Protection Act, which is where that comes from, I think that's the right quotation anyway. I believe it's worded in that you don't have to comply with a subject access request to the extent that it would require you to disclose information about third parties. Now, that's worded in a very specific way, which is that obviously you don't have to comply in areas or particular documents or particular instances where that would be the case. It's not a general exemption from the right of access if it involves third party data. So I assume that's possibly where that nuance has come from. But you're right, it's really important to get the wording right, because otherwise, as you say, you shouldn't have to go digging four pages down necessarily to clarify a bizarre statement like that.
Yeah, this is one of my favourite ones here, which we use in training quite a lot. Sorry if this feels like it's a bit of a hobby horse. It's not meant to be. So this is about, you know, this is the ICO's guidance on what is personal data. I think it's a great piece of work. And the Working Party 29 have also got a fantastic piece what is personal data. But we talk a lot about photographs, don't we? And this passage here, you know, the photograph of the shop includes images of pedestrians walking past at the time the photo was taken. The estate agent is not processing the shop data to learn anything about the pedestrians. This is kind of like, well, what's the purpose of the photograph? And therefore, it says further in here, in the hands of the estate agents, the photo does not contain personal data about pedestrians walking past their shop. So, you know, what we're now saying is that you have a look at some information, and then its purpose is vitally important to determining whether or not this is personal data or not. Now, this is 2012 guidance, so, you know, the definition of personal data has slightly changed, I suppose. But then they go on here to say, and I use this in training a lot, at about the same time the photograph was taken, a bank raid took place on the same high street. The police might make a public appeal for information about the movement on the high street at that time. The estate agent might supply to the police a copy of the photo in response to the appeal. The police would then process the photo, and at which point it may be personal data. So again, I say to people, you know, what you look at in one day may become personal data the next day, depending on what you're doing with it. And getting that concept, to kind of go back to understand that concept that information, it may be personal data one day and maybe not personal data the next day, is really, you know, and you're doing a sign, you're getting photographs, you know, what was the purpose of the photograph? Because in the ICO's guidance, surely that becomes relevant as to whether it's personal data, therefore disclosable. I mean, this is the sort of thing we love yarning about in the pub. I'm just going to flip back and kill my screen share. So that's one of my favourite passages. It's old now, 2012, but it's still there in the ISO's website. Therefore, you know, is it still relevant? Is it still persuasive?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? I was to hark back to the case I raised earlier, we were talking about mobile apps, because the ICO has a piece of guidance on privacy in mobile apps, guidance for developers.
They do, yeah.
But they
yeah.
released that in 2013. And again, you sort of ask yourself the question, you flick through it and go, well, how relevant is this now? And you have to sort of weigh it up. I mean, to be honest, in this particular context, I think it's still probably very relevant. There was nothing that sort of jumped out at me as being outdated when I had a flick through it. But you're right, it can be an issue.
Well, if you don't have the confidence to kind of work it through and challenge it, which many people don't because they haven't studied the law to that level, you feel kind of in limbo, a bit out to sea. And what's happened a couple of times, and I know Dilik's on the call, you know, somebody gets hold of this out of date data or looks at the ISO's website, the wrong piece, part of it, and starts challenging, you know, their data protection officer or us, saying, well, I've read here on the ISO's website, it says this, or I've read here in this guidance, it says that. Okay, well, you've got to take it in the round, you know, you've got to consider other factors. But, you know, if to some people, they don't, they look at the you know, the stuff that's out there, I'm like saying, get it up to date or take it down, because it can get misused. And we had a right ding dong with somebody who was, you know, telling us about subject action requests. We're reading the four data subjects part of the ICO's website. That's the wrong part to read. You need to be reading the stuff about controls and organizations, because you're a controller, you know, and what it says in the piece about data subjects in that context is not relevant. It's the wrong approach to take, but you know, they wouldn't have it. It was a difficult conversation.
I think there's possibly a wider point there, maybe about, I don't know, maybe it's a training issue potentially, but I've told you that on a number of occasions I've had issues with clients where they're just not, as you say, not reading the right part of either the guidance or sometimes not even the right part of the law. The number of times that we've had the Law Enforcement Directive incorrectly quoted at us, because that's obviously part three of the Data Protection Act, and people say, oh, under section X, the Data Protection Act, and you instantly go, well, hang on, that's the Law Enforcement Directive. Mm-hmm. You're a housing provider, that doesn't apply to you. Or, you know, the other one that I get all the time is people referring to a Schedule 2 exemption of the Data Protection Act, which is crime and crime prevention purposes. And they say, oh, well, under this, that's our lawful basis. I say, well, no, that's an exemption from providing privacy information or acknowledging subject rights. That's not a lawful basis. It specifically says right there that you can't rely on it as a lawful basis. So I don't know where that issue maybe stems from. Maybe it's a training thing. Maybe it's the responsibility of an organisation falling on the shoulders of someone who's possibly not come out for it. I don't know where it comes from, but it's something which we come up against constantly, misquoting things and misreading things.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the ICO's guidance on the GDPR, which I think my screen's flickering. I don't know if it's showing, but that has actually got version control in it. This is on version 61, and in it is what's changed. My screen's flickering. I don't know if you can see it. So they said in January 21, you know, they published an updated communication, you know, following the UK Trade Corporation Group. So absolutely on the money there, aren't they? That's very recent. But I don't think these what's new things account for 61 different changes. But I prefer to have this 300-page document in PDF because I can work through it. Rather than trying to navigate it on their website, which is how they seem to want to push out their guidance now. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that I would like to see in all guidance with, you know, we've changed this, you know, and therefore we've incremented the version number.
No, I'd have to agree with you on that. I would have to agree with you.
Yeah. So what about you know, the blogs, you know, what blogs and newsletters do you kind of subscribe to, Ollie? Where do you get information about this type of stuff? Where do you get other opinion about? Because it's not just what the guidance says, it's how it's interpreted, isn't it? It's what other people in the industry are saying about the law and about the guidance and about case law as well.
No, definitely. Well, I think very much like you, I'm an avid user of Lexology and their updates. Just very useful, bite-size. Timely.
That's a free one, isn't it, Lexology? It's a daily free newsletter.
I think they probably have a paid solution
as well. Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's always quite useful. And to be completely honest, I often find of real use to me is my network on LinkedIn. There's always good conversations on there. There's always things being shared. There's people who are always up to speed and on the money. Now, that's not to say that obviously differences of opinion don't mean that, you know, maybe people argue about things and maybe that some takes aren't quite right sometimes, but that's all part of it, really. I think even where something's been read slightly incorrect, that's still, there's still value in that, because you can have that conversation and you can find those developments and talk about them. I don't know how you feel about that aspect of it, but it's something that I've found quite useful of late, particularly.
It certainly is. The but the lexology, I think, is great. It's my first job I do every morning is just have a quick scan through. There's always something quite interesting, and usually you link through to an article written by usually a law firm. Some of it is recycling content, some of it's out of date, but in the main, I have to say, most days, you know, we find something that we either do blog about or could blog about. You know, it's some kind of stimulus to thought there, which I find very useful. But it's usually in lexology I find that the European Data Protection Board or the ICO you know, have issued new guidance, or that's where cases get commented on. So that, again, that's my usual source of finding out, oh, there's been an interesting case about, you know, the extraterritoriality being tested. You know, I found that through an article in lexology. So again, I keep all that lot in my library. But what I'm not very good at is the metadata bit. So searching for something, you know, I put it in the title, but what I'd like to be able to do is have a much better way of indexing this stuff. So if we're looking for, you know, cookies, then we find you know, the cookie law, the cookie guidance, and, you know, relevant, credible, useful guidance on cookies. Yeah, that's something that we've got as a target, haven't we, to improve our indexing of our library this year.
Sure. I mean, a lot of it, I think, for us and the rest of the support team, a lot of it's find out about these things through the grapevine, essentially, because then it's, yeah, you know, either it's lexology or it's yourself or it's one, or it's Dilik or it's Dave circulating it, or as I said before, through, you know, the social media and hearing about it that way, which isn't really the most effective way, arguably. That probably highlights a bit of an issue in terms of communication in the sector, possibly. But you do sometimes feel that you've missed something. You know, a big decision's handed down, you know, a new code of practice or piece of guidance is published. And I do find it sometimes really quite easy to miss these things, which is unfortunate. But,
yeah,
you know,
actually, one of my favourite pieces of guidance, yeah, for like forever, was way back like 1998, the ICO produced a data protection compliance audit handbook, and I've got that on because they gave it out at their show. What do they call it? Exhibition? No, they don't call it a show. They have an event, don't they, every year? If you're lucky to get on, if you do. But they used to give out this audit handbook on DVD, you know, I printed it out and put it together, and yeah, it's fine. It's for auditing compliance against the 98 Act, but it's a brilliant bit of guidance. It's got a whole front end is about audit theory, about sampling, about question phrasing, and then it's got, you know, how to go about auditing compliance against the DPA 98, and then a whole load of checklists. And you know, we used that as a basis for designing our own audit framework when we were, you know, doing a lot of compliance auditing and our audit training. It's really, really good. So that you can actually find it if you hunt about on the internet, but it's a really good read, and it's so relevant to, you know, if you're wanting to think about how are we going to actually audit this, you know, read through that. Yeah, okay, it's out of date and it needs tweaking, but it's a brilliant piece of work that they put together a long time ago. And you know, and again, that's good. There are people that kind of put this stuff out and hold it, you know, indefinitely. So you find it. Another thing that I struggle with a little bit with the ICO is another great source of